Attention broadcasters in the greater Portland area. Your daily show prep begins now.
And our final guest today is Nick Naylor. Mr. Naylor is the vice president of the Academy of Tobacco Studies. Now, they are the tobacco industry's main lobby in Washington, D.C., and Mr. Naylor is their chief spokesman.
Few people on this planet know what it is to be truly despised. Can you blame them? I earn a living fronting an organization that kills 1,200 human beings a day. 1,200 people. We're talking two jumbo jet plane loads of men, women, and children. I mean, there's Attila, Genghis, and me, Nick Naylor, the face of cigarettes, the Colonel Sanders of nicotine. This is where I work. The Academy of Tobacco Studies. It was established by seven gentlemen you may recognize from C-SPAN. These guys realized quick if they were going to claim that cigarettes were not addictive, they better have proof. This is the man they rely on. Ehrenhard von Gruppenmund. They found him in Germany. I won't go into the details. He's been testing the link between nicotine and lung cancer for 30 years and hasn't found any conclusive results. The man's a genius. He could disprove gravity. Most importantly, we've got spin control. That's where I come in. I get paid to talk. I don't have an MD or law degree. I have a bachelor's in kicking ass and taking names. You know that guy who can pick up any girl? I'm him on crack.
Indeed. And hello to you. It is 19 minutes after the hour of one, and this is the month of August in the year of our Lord 2010. Thank you for coming along and making a part of your listening day. We are live from the lushly appointed yet not really ostentatious studios of the Emerson News Network. This, my friends, is the Rick Emerson radio program. I am he. Thank you for joining us on this Tuesday. It's 503-505-6964 if you would like to join us today. 503-505-6964. 503-505-6964. You can also email if you like. It's rick@rickemerson.com. rick@rickemerson.com. You can also email Don Taylor if you like. It's Don, D-A-W-N, at rickemerson.com. Are you, in fact, checking your rickemerson.com email?
I am indeed.
I mean, not at this very moment, but in general.
Every single day. A couple of times a day.
If they were to send something to that address, it would be read. Maybe not responded to. Maybe deleted with extreme prejudice. Maybe snarled at.
I just looked at it again like 5 minutes ago.
All right,
I do check it. I do read it.
All right. So just in an overarching sense, you are checking that.
Normally, people only just copy me on things that they're sending to you.
Well, that's as it should be.
This is disgusting. You guys need to see it.
You get
that kind of thing.
Not counting Bruce Agler, do you get any of these emails? Do you get the, I don't know that Rick will actually read this. Would you make sure that he sees the, and then they'll, pass something to you that it really exists, want me to see it?
Yeah, I've got this one fellow who very much wants me to remind you to post the Clown Watch so
Damn it.
That people can download it.
I keep forgetting to do that. All right.
Can you bump me up a little bit?
If only I sweeten your mic.
Sweeten my mic, say in the biz.
You know why I say that?
Why?
Because Barry Manilow said that one time.
Oh.
And it is, now don't get me wrong, it is a real term.
Okay.
It is a real term, but that's not where I learned it. I mean, it is a thing that people actually say in the broadcasting industry. But I saw Barry Manilow in 1994, maybe? 1993? The first or second time I saw him. And he's just, he's just such a drama queen about everything. And he's just, I love Barry Manilow, but you get the sense that all the time, he is on the verge of firing everybody around him. You know, he's got that sort of barely held back seething bitterness about just everything. And I don't think it's just because he's, Barry Manilow. I think it's just the way I think he's a tightly wound little man. And the best ever example of that, by the way, was when he did the live all request Christmas spectacular on PBS like two Christmases ago, where it's like, you know, he goes to the PBS studio, the same place where they do the pledge drive and the telethon or whatever, and the deal is you would call the 800 number and they would screen your calls, or, you know, and I forget how it worked. But anyway, but you know, some of the calls would get put on with live with Barry, and he's there in a studio. It's not like he's at a venue, but he's at a studio with a little in-studio audience. And they'd take like a couple calls every hour, and you know, and you get to request like, Barry, could you please sing "Looks Like We Made It" for John and Annette? That would be great. But you could tell he's like Larry King in that he has so little patience for interacting with actual people, and it was just killing him because occasionally they would screen somebody sort of badly. And the woman, you know, he'd answer the phone. It's always a woman. It's always just like some ancient, like blue hair. And he would say, "All right, and it looks like we've got Emma. Is it Emma? Emma, hello, hi, Emma. What song do you want to hear?" And that is called. What song do you want to hear? That is a closed-ended question. That means, don't tell me your life story. That is, tell me if you want to hear Copacabana or Mandy, because time is ticking, and I'm Barry Manilow, and I don't have time to talk to you all day. And Emma will say, "Harry, first I want to tell you about something really nice you did for my sister in 1983. And I think he didn't know the camera was on him, and he just gave, it was the most pronounced eye roll. I'm just sort of like, where he's sitting there going, Christ almighty, another woman who smells of mothballs. I just want to get out of here and go have some tea. Anyway, but I saw Manilow in like 94, and he was doing that thing where he was giving the hand gesture. He's on stage, and this is the Delta Center, so it would have been 95. He's giving the hand stage to the guy, and we've all seen the guy on stage go where he points to his guitar and then jerks his thumb way up. And that's like, I'm a big dick who needs to be louder than everyone else. Please turn my instrument up, which is a thing I know well, by the way. And so, which is why, you know, they're hearing me complaining about my mic not being sweetened, because I've got the knob in front of me now. Now it is Rick Emerson who holds the power.
And your mic is always just a little bit louder
than mine. Yes, it is. I could take a photograph of it and post it if you'd like. Yeah. We should have, Rick,
I can see that.
Dawn, relative volume levels. If your phone has a camera, we can totally do that. Anyway, so I saw Manilow on stage, and he's doing the thing where he's pointing at the mic, and then he's jerking his thumb up. And the guy in the booth is just either not noticing or not caring, not responding to Barry Pincus' needs, though. And when one doesn't help out Barry Pincus doesn't help one out. And so he actually just stopped a song a few bars in. It was like Bandstand Boogie or something. And he actually just turned around and wound the band back down. And he said, I'm sorry, whoever's in the booth, and which is like, when he phrases it that way, that means like, whoever has a job for now but will not be employed later on this evening. Whoever has a job in the booth, could you please sweeten my mic just a bit if it's not too much trouble? Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. And it was so clear to everybody kind of what was going on. It was, you know, not that I mind. It's Barry Manilow. He can have his mic as sweet as he'd like it. And but I immediately began working that into my conversational style. So that's a thing I just say now. But it is an actual term. But I stole that from Barry Manilow, like everything else I do.
Well, I was talking about this on Ham-Fisted Radio with Mr. Fatboy Roberts, my co-host over there. And we were talking about where I asked him to turn my mic up a bit. And then I mentioned you saying sweeten the mic, and he's like, is that a term? I'm like, I guess it's a term. It's some of those terms, you know, like pot it up, pot it down. And the two of us being Johnny come latelys to this whole radio business, we then talked for about 15 minutes about, why don't they just say turn it up? Why can't you just say turn it up or just slide the thing? It's a slider. Just say slide the slidey thing.
Now, are these things you actually want answers to? Because you've got questions. Rick Emerson has tedious knowledge.
I actually, at one time, when I was... when I learned how to use all the equipment over at KBOO, back before they, you know...
Before they fired you for being on my show?
Yeah.
Awesome.
I remember at some time there was discussion about why it's called a pot and why you pot up and
it's
pot
called
down.
A pot
I don't
because
remember why.
Here's the thing. Do I have I should get like a World of Knowledge sort of a bed here or something. Let's see if I've got a... No.
That one is almost never it.
Why is that the button for everything? Why is every... Why would you even have that button? Anyway, I remember what I was saying. So just real quickly, here's a crash course. Because here's the thing is, I am fascinated by, sometimes frustrated by, but usually fascinated by, lingo in various jobs or various industries. For example, let me just ask you this, because I know this is the case. What is some lingo in the newspaper industry? You know, something that, in other words, not for something that doesn't exist in the rest of the world, because that's just the thing's name, but where you guys you call something something else?
Well, two that immediately spring to mind. One is lead, and the lead on your story. You'd think it would be LEAD because it's the lead, it's the beginning, but it's actually LEDE.
I didn't know that.
Is the actual spelling
really?
Of it. Although it's over time, it's come to be people actually spell it LEAD more and more.
Why is it spelled LEDE?
I don't remember. I looked it up once to try and explain it, but it's one of those arcane terms that has come down, I think, probably from printing presses or something
weird.
Like that. And another is that always drove me crazy is when they refer to any areas of text as the gray space.
Because it's unimportant. It's not an ad.
And that was also explained to me why my editors at the Tribune kept cutting up all of my paragraphs into one sentence chunks. Because it's like, well, it's just a visual thing. They don't like to see too much gray space. And there's this thing that if readers see too much gray space, they'll think, oh, that's going to be too hard for me to read. I'll only read it if it's in one sentence chunks, and because I'm not smart enough to read an entire paragraph.
It's like books now. Like you go through books and they have a lot of diagrams and illustrations and factoids and everything looks like Maxim magazine. Because if you see a lot of words on the page, it could take you all day, and you won't be able to watch Bowling for Dollars or whatever. Okay, that's interesting. What is wood in the newspaper industry? Do they talk about having wood, blah blah blah? But they talk about getting wood or printing the wood. Is that a thing they say?
I don't think I've ever heard that.
I'm thinking of something else.
It might be a thing.
It seems
I don't remember.
In that movie, The Paper with Michael Keaton, it seems like they were talking about
printing
the wood.
It's like when you're finishing it all up and getting ready to you're saying, okay, we're done, we're ready, it's going to go to the printer. You say you're putting the paper to bed.
Hey, you know who we could ask about that? Joseph Rose, Oregonian traffic reporter. God, I'm dumb.
Sure.
I just put all that together. It says Oregonian guy, guest today, in huge letters over to my right.
And he probably also knows arcane traffic lingo as well.
That is true. We're going to ask him about that. But I'm fascinated by lingo that stuff, so we'll get to that. So coming up, later on, about 25 minutes from now or so, Mr. Joseph Rose, he is a traffic reporter for the Oregonian, is going to be in studio with us. And on the one hand, there's many things to ask him. On the other hand, I don't even know where to begin. So, as is the case with every interview, it's always about what is the first question you ask. Because without Outlook Portland, I put a lot of time into prepping for that, but I put extra time into the first question. So we should figure out what is the first question.
The first question is, are you an angry driver?
We should ask him. No. But you see, you're onto something there. To get to who is Joseph Rose as a person, we should ask something about his own personal driving behavior, or like, or something that indicates maybe how he conducts himself.
Yeah.
Like, does he have more than one bumper sticker?
Yeah.
What bumper sticker annoys him the most?
What kind of a car does he drive?
What is your life? When are you home alone?
What route do you take to work and when?
Give me all your money.
What's in your wallet right now?
How long could you hold your breath? This took a morbid turn. Joseph Rose, Oregonian traffic reporter, is going to be with us later on today. We also have a Geek Watch coming out today. Peanuts Watch, another installment of The Greatest Songs Ever Made. Now, is that an ironic woohoo?
No, I'm excited.
All right, just checking. So we got the...
I don't necessarily always think that the songs you think are the greatest songs are the greatest songs. But then when you start to explain your reasoning, I always learn something.
It's a relative thing. I mean, and also, let's be honest, if there's like 5 billion songs in existence and half of 1% of them are some of the greatest ever, that's still like thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands. So, I mean,
you always share this interesting background information, and I am always interested in cramming more knowledge into my head that will keep me from learning valuable things like
CPR.
State capitals or algebra.
That's coming up later on. Then your chance to do that. Your chance to deny yourself of facts that actually help. Because, this show is, this show is sort of like opening up your head, removing all your extra knowledge and filling it with packing peanuts. But packing peanuts made of chocolate. All right. So Geek Watch on the way. Penis Watch on the way. Greatest songs ever made. We got to recap Mad Men, and we should have done that yesterday. And I even reminded us to do it, and then I reminded myself, and then I just forgot. So we got to recap Mad Men, and Don Taylor's track and the following headlines for you on this Tuesday as well.
Gay people in California must wait to get married during the Proposition 8 appeal. There's a $3.7 million lawsuit that's been filed here in Portland. And a group of lost hikers were rescued 3 times during their being lost in Cedar Lake, Illinois.
Really?
Yeah. They were rescued 3 times during one trip.
by the same group of...
You will have to wait to hear the story, Mr. Emerson.
Damn you. Damn you and your crafty teasing.
That's why it's called a tease.
All right. Well, in any event, blah da blah da blah. This is where we talk about what we did last night. But my night was pretty uninteresting.
Mine was, too. Let's talk about badminton instead.
Okay, but real quickly. Lingo. Here's to answer your radio question.
Okay.
Lingo,
I'd already forgotten about that.
Yeah, no, I'm here to remember. Because lingo is sometimes sort of irritating. Specifically, a lot of, like, music and radio lingo, I find it just bugs me for some reason. Like, here's the thing that bugs me. I don't know why. And this is, by the way, a thing that a certain type of old guy does. Old radio guy. And I mean old, like, 90 years old. I mean old, like, one of those, like, you know, like the same kind of, like, a 60-year-old guy who works at Kink, theoretically. The same kind of guy who describes guitar playing as being tasty licks. That guy. He will always describe old blues records, about which he believes himself to be a genius, as being not songs or singles, but sides.
Oh, yeah.
It was an old blues side by Muddy Waters. I just want to go, shut your head. Shut your head. Don't ever speak again. You are in Portland. You are bald with a ponytail. You may no longer speak.
Shut your head is a lovely thing, I think, to say to anyone.
I love shut your head. That's I'm a big fan of shut your head. Occasionally, it becomes a shut your sass hole. but shut your head is kind of that's my go-to. So there's sides. But then again, when you're auditioning for like a movie or TV show, I didn't know this. The script, it's what you and I and everybody else would call a script. When you're auditioning, it's not a script. They're sides.
Yeah.
Print out the sides. And the sides is like the page you're using to audition. It was just weird. I don't even know where that comes from. Anyway, in radio, you talked about, and this is a thing everybody giggles about for like 5 minutes when they first get into radio or broadcasting school or whatever, that the knob that you or the slider, and the reason you don't call it a slider, the thing that controls your volume, like the thing I can use right now to turn Dawn completely off. See, like that? Isn't that right, Dawn? That's
now
right, there you go. See, I turned you off. The reason you don't call it a slider or a knob is because it's not always a slider. It's not always a knob. Sometimes it's a dial or it's a knob or it's an automated thing. You know, it's sort of, it's a series of whatever. The reason you call it a pot is because that is short for potentiometer. And potentiometer is something that effectively, it just controls the amount of transduced audio that is able to be released, out to the good people. So a potentiometer is like a resistor for audio. So that's where pot comes from.
Huh.
There was something else you asked me about, but I can't remember what it was.
Yeah.
Pot and something.
I don't know.
Nah, it's gone. All right. It is the Rick Emerson radio program. It's 503-505-6964. Let me see if I can carefully segue out of this here. Hold on a second. One more while I'm getting the Mad Men bed. And we did this one on Sunday, actually. We were talking, you and Bruce and Sherilyn over here, talking about a traffic log. You work in, that's a thing where if you work in radio and you talk about, where's our traffic department at? And the traffic department in radio is not a guy who actually follows, like, what happens with cars on the road. That is a guy who figures out when commercials are played. You know, the traffic department just tracks all of the commercials or spots that are played on the air. And I have no idea. That one just seems like it was designed solely to confuse people. It seems like there was really no reason for that to exist at all. What's up with your ankle?
I think something bit me. And so I have one of those.
Hope I didn't bring a spider in from home by walking through the web.
I hope you didn't, because
that'd be unfortunate, Don.
Yeah.
All right. I got this email. We'll kick off today's Mad Men recap, and it is Tuesday, by the way. You're not. Good God, woman! You want a stick? You want a pointed thing over there?
No,
no, no. Hold on. We have to see if I turn this up loud enough. I can hear the scratching.
No, you can't. That's not me.
That's just me rubbing my face.
Okay.
All right, there you go.
I'm done
all right.
Now.
You okay over there?
Yeah.
All right. Fantastic. So you are listening, in fact, to Tuesday's show, which is that we forgot to do the recap of Sunday's Mad Men on Monday because we're lame. So I'm just going to start with this. This comes to us, let's see, via the email at rick@rickemerson.com about Mad Men. What was the significance of the hallway scene at the end? That's where Dawn is standing there, and there's the old couple, and did you get eggs? I'll tell you inside. Did you get gherkins? I'll tell you inside. And it's the old couple arguing over the groceries. He says, I thought perhaps to show Dawn pondering living his whole life alone contrasted with the elderly couple, but they didn't seem all that happy for that to be what they meant to convey. What was the significance of the hallway scene? Okay, I can't take credit for this because somebody else made this observation. Here was the take on why the hallway scene at the end. It was that it was an entire episode. And I've never, see, I don't notice things like this because I'm not that bright. It was an entire episode of Mad Men apparently constructed around the divisions, physical divisions between people using doors and walls and windows as a sort of a construct, a symbol. And so they noted that, you know, there was like the hallway and the door and the, you know, Don and the married couple and they're going into different halls or going into different doors in the hallway. Whatever. There was the sequence in the office where when Pete is getting ready to go to lunch or when Peggy's getting ready to go to lunch with all the youth, the young people, she is on the other side of a glass door that swings shut between her and Pete Campbell, which is because she's going to lunch with the kids and he's staying behind. So that's very much like an age division thing.
Well,
being
and not
symbolized.
Just between her and Pete Campbell, between her and the office, between her and her coworkers, between her and all of the people that she had previously thought she wanted to be.
Right.
And now she is moving in a different direction with a different group of people, looking back over her shoulder through the glass door at where she was.
So that's a thing I never see, and I'm terrible at symbolism. I never, ever, ever pick up symbolism. But apparently that was the thing, is the episode was replete with doors and windows being used. And then I thought about another one, actually. There is that sequence earlier on when the secretary goes nuts and throws the thing at Don and breaks his glass. Mm-hmm. And then Peggy is actually in her adjoining office, standing at a desk, looking through a window at Don.
Yeah.
And that is sort of a window into her potential future.
See, and I was thinking also the last scene with the couple. Did you get pairs? And then the woman says to the man, like, we'll talk about it when we get inside, and then closes the door. Because there was also the entire thing about the focus group and them watching the focus group and trying to find out what people really want and what people really like. And there is discussion about the fact that you don't know. You really don't know from manipulating people what they do in the privacy of their own homes. And that last bit is Don basically on the outside watching this couple, and they are not having a discussion until they are in the privacy of their home.
Well,
so,
done, Don Taylor.
That's what
snatching the pebble from my hand. All right, so there's that. How about this? You guys always mention how Don is clearly a bad person, but I've never felt that. Except adopting a false identity. Now, I don't think he's trying to be flip.
No, I know.
Adopting a false identity and the flip comment the unkind comment he made to the gay colleague last season. The things he's done don't seem particularly worse than what most people do. He can seem oblivious to other people's feelings when he responds to them, and he wasn't a faithful husband, has sex with women, seems pretty average to me. Even though his secretary called him out saying, you're a bad person, and then he was clearly demonstrating what a therapist would call transference by getting upset at the focus group tester because he feels that what someone has done in his past shouldn't be an indicator of what they're going to do in the future, which obviously hits home, I don't get him being a, quote, bad person. Don Taylor in the back.
I think that Don is a damaged person. I mean, it depends on your, on how you decide what makes a person a bad person. I don't think Don is a deliberately bad person. Don is not, you know, yes, he was deceitful when it came to, like, changing his life, but he did it with a certain intent to make things better for himself. I don't think he intended at any point to harm anyone else. And I think he didn't think that he was harming Betty by keeping a secret from her all those years. But I think what we're seeing, particularly in this last episode, is that Don is starting to realize that he is not a good person. And that's part of what this was about, is because it was really well illustrated with his secretary,
Allison,
asking him for a letter of recommendation.
Right.
And he says, well, why don't you just type something up yourself and I'll sign it. He thinks he's being magnanimous. He thinks he is offering her a great deal.
Right.
That he will sign anything she says. And he just completely does not understand that what she wants is for him to validate her. She wants his words. She wants him to sit down and say, these are the things that were good about her.
All right, I have to interrupt you because here's a is also awkward. Not to rehash the whole thing, but you know, there's this whole thing, blah 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 blah. Right? I referred to Cheryl Kinnico as being the Peggy to my Don. Mm. Blah blah blah. And then I've just never heard the end of it. And I'm not saying that I'm like Don Draper. You know, that I'm not saying I'm nearly that cool or, you know, the whatever. But there's something about that episode on Sunday that did hit home with me, and it made me think again. You're like, well, am I secretly, or maybe not so secretly, just a dick? I wait now for the three-part harmony in the audience to say yes. Okay. Because here's the thing. When she says, can you write me a letter of recommendation? And he says, you just write whatever you want me to say, and I'll sign it. And then it clearly is like being painted as like a dick move. Here's the thing. I always do that. That is what I always do. Every time I have ever been asked to write a letter of recommendation, I have done exactly that. I did that for Sarah. I've done that for scores of people who have worked for me, where they say, will you write me a letter of recommendation? And I'm like, you write it, I'll sign it. Doesn't matter what it is. Give it to me. Totally thought that that was the right thing to do. That seems like a magnanimous because I don't know what job they're applying for, what they want to highlight about themselves. And then it requires like some weird interview process otherwise, or else you're going to get it wrong.
But say the thing is with Don, this is exactly the same thing as him giving a list of gifts to his secretary to buy to his kids for his kids for Christmas. You know, he thinks he's being a good dad.
Right.
He's getting them what they want for
sure.
Christmas. But he's not going and doing the work himself. He's handing the money to his secretary, and she's taking care of it for him.
Nah, then that's not the same thing at all.
No, it is. It is the same thing.
It is not. With the letter of recommendation, he is empowering her to describe herself as she sees herself, not as he sees her. You would think that would be good.
And that's what he thinks. But in reality, what he's doing is he's not doing something personal that he should do himself.
Pig man.
And in this particular case, I think most people would be okay with it. But, you know, he slept with her. She's leaving because he slept with
her.
Well,
that's a fair point.
And then tried to kind of pretend that it never happened.
Well, that's, you know, did you notice, by the way, that I had this whole thing where he was, after he slept with her, I was sort of, maybe not cutting him slack as such, but it was indistinct to me. I was unclear whether he might have actually just only fuzzily remembered it or maybe not remembered it at all. And it's interesting that whether she believes it or not, Allison actually said that. She said, well, okay, let's talk about Mad Men, the end of that episode where she's talking to Peggy and she inadvertently reveals to Peggy that she effed Don because she assumes that Peggy has. And then Peggy just gives her like the hard smackdown, which was awesome.
Yeah, Peggy's reaction was really surprising.
It was fantastic. It was really just a great moment on that show. I didn't see it coming. It was
well,
really
considering
amazing.
That Peggy is such a sort of a hard to read character to figure out where she. That was just like that was a huge insight into Peggy. Right
when
there.
She said, "Your problems are not mine," and the great thing about that is that has more than one meaning.
Yeah.
Which is first of all like you effed Don and I didn't. So that any you know whatever you're dealing with, I'm not dealing with. And also the other great thing about that to me is, and this is why I stand by my thing about how Peggy is a great empowered character because she is self actualizing, as Maslow would say. She's becoming her own person because she is saying, your problems are your own, your life is your own, because I am on a different path with my existence than you are,
yeah.
Secretary who effed the boss.
Exactly.
So but she's just a great character. Here's the one complaint, and it's a real minor beef that I have with Sunday's Mad Men. It's a real minor complaint, and that is this. And maybe this is a thing that either A, I'm supposed to notice, and so maybe in other words, maybe I'm seeing something as ham-handed that isn't ham-handed. Maybe it is supposed to be really obvious, and I'm just overthinking it. Or maybe, I don't know, or maybe I just somehow am hyper-aware of it. Mad Men, not unlike a great many television shows, telegraphs like 9 miles away when somebody is going to come out as gay.
Oh, God, yes.
How could the woman in the elevator have been more of a Gloria Steinem?
Oh,
I mean,
dear Lord. The raised eyebrows and the,
and
hey, I'm going to check her out later.
Leering at her after, for like 5 seconds, she leered
that
at Peggy.
That was painful. That was just painful.
And I mean, and she's got straight ironed hair and she's wearing
dark eyebrows.
And she has
very dark eyebrows.
Yeah, and she's not wearing any makeup and she's wearing like a very like a dull sort of sweater. And I was like, oh. Could she possibly be dykier, you know? And it's like, which, you know, it's not like there's anything wrong with that.
No,
I'm just saying
it's just
supposed to be a reveal, and it was the most obvious thing on Earth.
It's just the most, it was the most ham-fistedly obvious setup.
Where I think with Sal, you were supposed to know.
Yeah.
Because I think that was a little bit of symbolism with Sal, where it was the willful blindness of the time.
Right.
That you didn't see gays because you couldn't even really conceive that you might know one in life, you know, because they're those people.
Yeah.
But with her,
people would refer to, Charles Nelson Reilly as flamboyant.
Yeah. And it's
not think he was gay.
Yeah. And nobody ever just said, like, well, but he's a, you know. one of them that don't like girls because they just couldn't even conceive of it. But yeah, with the chick in the elevator, yeah. It was having her dressed sort of in a whatever you want to call it, plain fashion or whatever. That's one thing. I mean, I guess I could almost get, but just the fact that they had her just leering.
It was the raised eyebrow, and everything.
And a woman wrote that episode, not a man. Which surprised me.
Well, the leering thing, though, it doesn't... I mean, you have to look at the script to see if that's actually on the page or how much of that is direction.
Maybe. That's true. Maybe, and I'm trying to say that, a man had to have done that, but that's the sort of thing you would figure that a guy would do, because... all things being equal, especially I think in 1964, chicks didn't do a lot of public leering at other chicks.
Not so much.
And that's why the thing about... Here's the other thing, and I don't know, because I'm not a 1964 lesbian, but the thing of her kissing Peggy... on the cheek, but obviously in a sexual way at the party, rang a little false to me. Because it's like, she's only known her for 12 seconds. And also, it's like pre-Stonewall, it's pre-everything. That struck me as a little...
That whole little sidebar was really awkward to me.
Just real quickly here, and then we're running behind, so we got to catch up.
We're running way behind.
Because we didn't do last week, I got to say this one thing. I don't know whether we're going to get to see, Anne, the real Don Draper's wife in California.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if we get to see her again, or maybe in flashback, or, in other words, I don't know if the character's going to die before we get to see her again. I will really miss her, though, because Don's scenes with her, the character Don Draper scenes with Anne, the real Don Draper's wife, the guy that he stole his identity from, Don Draper's widow, are some of the best on the show.
Yeah.
Because, and that's a great thing about John Hamm, is he does this subtle shift where he is more relaxed, and it is like he can be himself. Those are the only moments where Dick Whitman is himself. He is actually himself. And as a viewer, I love those because I feel like I can relax. Because it's like he can sort of go, nobody knows me here, I can be myself.
I loved the takedown, though, when he started to switch into Don Draper mode with the daughter, about her cancer. And the girl was having none of it, but then she tells him about the cancer, and it was just like this huge bucket of cold water on him that pulled him out of Don Draper mode and back to Dick Whitman, and he just was so lost for a moment.
Because in Los Angeles, he didn't have any power. In Los Angeles, he's not anybody who matters. He's not a man who can get things done. He's just some guy that doesn't have any rights at all. And I am fascinated by his relationship with her, and what it must have been in the past. And I almost, in a way, don't want to see it explicated. I almost don't want to see too much of it. So anyway, so there you go. And the bed ended right on time. Oh no, it didn't. All right. I thought I'd just timed that out perfectly there, so... All right. Excellent. Good God almighty. All right, it's 1:55. Jesus Christ. Well, we should probably just break here in a second, and we should probably break, and then we'll come back with Joseph Rose, Oregonian traffic reporter. Coming up later on today, we have the Geek Watch on the way, Peanuts Watch, coming up as well. This isn't going to print, so I'm just going to have to do this off the screen is what I'm going to have to do. Don Taylor, let's just give then another brief overview. Yes?
Nothing.
You were just scratching yourself for the 50th time.
No, I was pointing at something on a piece of paper and it went beautifully for a second.
Oh, I wasn't talking about that.
And you nodded and then boom, it was just like...
No, I thought you were doing... No. I did it. My peripheral vision. I thought you were doing another...
No.
Getting your scratch on.
Not even close.
Let's do this. Let's do another, just an overview of the headlines that are coming up, and then we'll do Greatest Songs Ever Made, and then we will take a break. We'll come back after this with Joseph Rose from the Oregonian.
A $3.7 million lawsuit has been filed here in Portland. California gay people must wait to wed during the Proposition 8 appeal. And a group of lost hikers were rescued 3 times during one weekend.
Now, Jiz, you don't have to give me the answer, but does the story in fact reveal whether they were rescued by the same, way more generous than I would be, county types? Does it reveal that?
Yes, it does reveal that.
All right, fantastic. Excellent. All right. And coming up here in just a few, we'll talk to Mr. Joseph Rose from the Oregonian, traffic reporter. My name is Rick Emerson, and it's time for The Greatest Songs Ever Made. Men and women are strange creatures, indeed. Yeah, even stranger when love enters the equation. Priorities shift and change, and loyalty becomes a thing of nearly intangible description. People in love are unpredictable. They're a blend of behaviors. and unpredictable is exactly what you might call the artist you're about to hear and the song she wrote in 1968. Now, refusing to be consigned to the role traditionally occupied by female singers and musicians, she blazed a new trail, especially in her given genre. She drew songs from her own life, even when that life clashed with the morality dictated by her upbringing, the country, the time, and her musical pedigree. And speaking of clashes, there are few things more exhaustively discussed in country music than infidelity. The cheating louse, the unfaithful Jezebel, the evil seductress, all have their parts to play, all are archetypes, and all play their parts dutifully, most of the time. Certain songs, however, refuse to play nice, avoiding the easy boxes of right and wrong, making us confront the endless complexity of human behavior. Now, as previously noted on these airwaves, Jolene by Dolly Parton is one such song, as is today's piece. The second number one hit for Loretta Lynn, the first being 1967's Don't Come Home A-Drinkin' with Lovin' on Your Mind, the song you'll hear today is sung by a female narrator who issues the stock, "You'd better stay away from my man," warning. The woman being warned, of course, is the seductress. However, the song's lyrics make clear that the narrator, Loretta Lynn, not only believes it possible that her husband could cheat, but is certain that he has cheated and that he will cheat again. In fact, she seems to nearly revel in her husband's ongoing Lothario-style behavior, and in terms that must have seemed risque, even in 1968. That, of course, does not stop the narrator from threatening the seductress and her husband. A tiny, loud-voiced country singer of female country songs threatening violence against anyone who calls out her husband on his notorious cheating behavior. The sound you will hear is love, intriguing, fascinating, and unpredictable. The sound you hear is one of the greatest songs ever made, Loretta Lynn and Fist City on the Rick Emerson Radio Program.
You've been making your brags around town that you've been loving my man. But the man I love, when he picks up trash, he puts it in a garbage can. And that's what you look like to me, and what I see's a pity. You better close your face and stay out of my way if you don't want to go to Fist City. If you don't want to go to Fist City, you better detour around my town. 'Cause I'll grab you by the hair of the head and I'll lift you off of the ground. I'm not a saying my baby's a saint, 'cause he ain't, and that he won't pat around with a kitty. I'm here to tell you, gotta lay off of my man if you don't wanna go to Fist City. Come on and tell me what you told my friends, if you think you're brave enough. And I'll show you what a real woman is, since you think you're hot stuff. You'll bite off more than you can chew if you get too cute or witty. You better move your feet if you don't want to eat a meal that's called Fist City. If you don't want to go to Fist City, you better detour around my town. 'Cause I'll grab you by the hair of the head and I'll lift you off of the ground. I'm not a sin, my baby's a saint, 'cause he ain't, and that he won't pat around with a kitty. I'm here to tell you, gotta lay off of my man if you don't want to go to Fist City. I'm here to tell you, gotta lay off of my man if you don't want.
It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Thank you for joining us today. It's 503-505-6964. 503-505-6964. Thank you for joining us. Coming up later on today, Geek Watch, Penis Watch, and Mr. Joseph Rose, Oregonian traffic reporter, who I believe may himself be causing some traffic. It seems he's running a little late. He's on the way. And we want to remind you, today's Rick Emerson Show, like every day's Rick Emerson Radio Program, is made possible by folks such as Michael Beatty of The Cleaning Solution. He's the owner and proprietor of The Cleaning Solution. They can be reached at 971-533-3211. 971-533-3211. Talk more about that here in just a bit. Without further ado, will you please give your full attention to Ms. Dawn Taylor.
And now, from the news desk, this is Dawn Taylor.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's totally my fault there. Go ahead. Your mic was completely unsweetened.
The family of a college student struck and killed while crossing the street has filed a $3.7 million lawsuit against the city of Portland. Lindsay Leonard and Jessica Finley were crossing Foster Road at Southeast 80th Avenue in November 2009 when they were hit by a passing car. In a wrongful death lawsuit filed by Leonard's family, lawyers said the street light above the crosswalk was not lit and created hazardous conditions for pedestrians. The wrongful death complaint also said the stop line and crosswalk markings were in disrepair and that some of the white markings on the road were missing. The complaint alleged that city officials had been aware of the issues at the intersection for at least 1 year prior to the collision. The suit also blames Portland General Electric for the unlit streetlight. Police never cited or charged the driver involved with the crime, but the lawsuit names him and his company, which owned the car he was driving. Prior to the defendant's vehicle colliding with pedestrians, he took no action to avoid the collision, the complaint said.
Now, where is this? This is the...
Foster and 80th.
Foster and 80th, first of all, that's a bad place.
Yeah.
A bad place filled with bad people and bad cars, taking other bad people to do bad things.
Yeah, a crosswalk in disrepair and an unlit street light.
Yeah.
Shocking.
Foster is just... It's just one of those places where you just... You don't want to traffic in stereotypes, but it's just such a terrible part of town. And everything there is falling apart. That being said, I mean... How do I put this? That being said... What did it say? What time was it? At night? Was it to say? Was it the? Was it absolutely like? If the light was out, it seems like it's indicating it must have happened after dark, right?
It doesn't say.
But I mean, you got to figure.
Yeah, so the street light was out, was not lit, so I would say that would be nighttime.
I understand that if the street light isn't out and maybe the crosswalk is, you know, like falling apart and hasn't been repaired or whatever. I get that, and so maybe it makes it difficult to see the pedestrian. On the other hand, cars have what are those things? They've had them for like headlights. And you would think that maybe you could see, you know, the car coming. Again, I'm not saying that, you know, I am not ascribing or apportioning blame in any sort of ratio. I'm just saying you cannot assume ever that anybody is just going to be paying attention and they're going to see what they're doing. I always just assume that no one can see me. I play a little game called Invisible Pedestrian where I just figure that no one else is able to see me or get a fix on me.
I'm also just thinking, you know, the complaint also says that the stop line and crosswalk markings were in disrepair. And it's like, I think that's kind of quibbling when it comes to like not seeing a person.
Well, it's not like the car can, you know, can see the crosswalk lines anyway.
Yeah.
You know, from 100 feet away. I'm just saying that, you know, we drive defensively. You gotta walk defensively. I mean, I'm not trying to be crass about it. I'm just saying, like, when you cross the street, you got to look both ways and then do it again. And then maybe a third time.
We ostensibly will be having Joseph Rose, traffic reporter for the Oregonian, in here, and this is one of those things we'll be talking about traffic. But the theory I eventually came up with after driving here for a few years, coming from a large metropolitan area as I did, is basically that in the grand scheme of things, traffic is a relatively new phenomenon in Portland, like real honest-to-God traffic. And so drivers here often, they're a lot like animals on Discovery Channel documentaries who live in areas with few or no natural predators.
And then you introduce, Tasmanian devil and he decimates everything.
And they just don't know how to, you know, defend themselves.
No, I'm with you on that.
So
I can see that.
I think pedestrians here are the same thing because you're downtown. And I don't think I've ever been in a major city where I've seen as many people jaywalk as I do here. They just don't care.
The only place where I've seen people jaywalk as much as they do here is almost not even comparable. It's New York. Because in New York, it's just like, in New York, if you don't jaywalk, you're part of the problem because you're holding up guys behind you, you know, who are trying to cross. It's not even an analog to the thing because in New York, when you're jaywalking, and everyone does, I mean, in New York, I don't even know why the lights are there. I mean, to be honest, if you've ever been in Manhattan, you know what I'm talking about. They're not even decorative, you know. They're just there for no readily apparent reason, the crosswalk lights. But so many people are in Manhattan that when you are walking, it's not like the car is somehow going to not see you. I mean, there's basically a wall of people. Yeah. So, I mean, the car will stop. And plus, also, jaywalking is just, it just seems to be an embedded part of the New York culture, and everybody knows the deal. And also, there are so few cars, relatively speaking, in Manhattan, that it's not like they're going 70 miles an hour down the street, as opposed to here. You got some cities, like in Seattle. You know, you try to jaywalk in Seattle, I mean, they'll F you hard for that. Yeah. The cops will actually turn around, stop their car, get out, and track you down. Like, they'll follow you down the street and ticket you if they see you jaywalking
in Southern California as well. I mean, that's the thing, is that if you're downtown at any given time, you can always tell the people who are visiting from another city or, like me, moved here from L.A. because we're the idiots who are standing there on the corner actually waiting for the light to change.
Right. Yeah, I do it sometimes only because I get that reflexive thing of not wanting to be ticketed. But no, here, people just sort of wade, you know, into – but it's like they always tell motorcycle guys. They say if you your first day in a motorcycle class, they say just pretend that you are invisible and assume that no one can see you, and that's your best route to be in the – you know, to be in safe. By the way, while we're on the subject of motorcycles and traffic and you know, everything vehicular – I'm going to create a bumper sticker and I'm going to sell it. And it's going to be an adjunct to the Start Seeing Motorcycles bumper sticker, which seems to really be pointless. I mean, that's a there is no one who is a reckless driver who is going to have his life changed by a bumper sticker. That's not really how existence that's not how humans work. Humans don't turn their life around because, you know, they saw something that encouraged them to be nice to your honor student. It's just not on the cards. So there's the Start Seeing Motorcycles thing. I want to agree with this. I'd like to quit hearing motorcycles. That's what my bumper sticker is going to say. And the idea that somehow that like the noise of a motorcycle is directly related to how safe they are, I think has been disproven like scores of times. So, I'll start seeing it when I no longer have to hear it while I'm trying to like sleep, you know, to just be somewhere where I don't want to have to hear your, you know, penis extension, you know, at 300 decibels.
Yeah, one of my neighbors has a gigantic like Gold Wing or something with all the boxes and bells and whistles. I think it's yelling dad across the way. And it's not even the loudness of the motorcycle per se, the engine, is the fact that he has the stereo,
you know, on the motorcycle.
On the motorcycle. Yeah. And he comes rolling in with the stereo blaring because, of course, he's got a helmet on and he's riding a motorcycle.
Right.
So it has to be really loud.
The Doobie
so he
Brothers
can hear
has
it.
To be really turned up.
And he pulls into his carport and turns off the motorcycle and then leaves this radio thing blaring for like 5 minutes.
So you get to hear China Grove whether you want to or not. I mean,
and then he hops off and starts screaming at his kids.
Well, and the other thing is it is the volume, but it's also with motorcycles especially. I mean, I don't mean to single out Harley owners because I know that that's like – Harleys are like pit bulls where they have a lot of – they're visible. There's a lot of name recognition. You know, they have a high profile, so everybody goes right to them. So I'm not saying it's just Harleys. But, I mean, we all know like that guy that has the motorcycle – that has clearly – and the reason I say it's not a safety issue is because if it was a safety issue, every motorcycle on earth would sound that loud. I mean, this country loves regulations. If that was actually a safety thing, you couldn't buy a quiet motorcycle. Those are guys who have gone because they are compensating for something somewhere in their life, and I'm not going to opine. But those are guys who have deliberately looked for a motorcycle that's going to irritate the squares. Like, because they all in their head think that they're like Captain America from, you know, 1968. So, but it's – there's something about the particular tone. It is the frequency at which a lot of those Harley-type motorcycles that they idle or, you know, whatever, the actual frequency of the sound, where it just like rattles the fillings in your teeth. And you can hear it. I swear to Christ, you can hear it 7 miles away. And here's how I know this, because my house is flanked by these guys. I mean, they're rampant. They're on my street like bedbugs in a Holiday Inn. And – there's one of them that has a job somewhere, probably somewhere very reputable, at 1 in the morning. Because every night at around 12:30, I hear him go out, fires it up. No matter the season, just lets it idle for like 10 minutes. And then he, you know, cranks it up, leaves. And I swear to God, I can still hear the thing as he's shifted through 19 gears and he's in another county. And it's still coming in, you know, the window of my home office. So just to put a sock in it, friend. Here's Don Taylor.
Gay couples who had been gearing up to get married in California this week had to put their wedding plans on hold once again after a federal appeals court said it wanted to consider the constitutionality of the state's same-sex marriage ban. A 3-judge panel of the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals imposed an emergency stay Monday on a trial court judge's ruling overturning the ban, known as Proposition 8. Chief U.S. District Court Judge Vaughn Walker had ordered state officials to stop enforcing the measure starting Wednesday, clearing the way for county clerks to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples. "It's saddening just to know that we still have to keep waiting for this basic human right," said Marcia DeVallos of Los Angeles, a healthcare advocate who'd planned to marry her partner, Lorette Healy, when the stay was issued Monday. "We were getting excited, and all of a sudden it's like, ugh, it's a roller coaster." Lawyers for the two gay couples who challenged the ban said Monday they would not appeal the panel's decision on the stay to the U.S. Supreme Court. They said they were satisfied the appeals court had agreed to fast-track its consideration of the Proposition 8 case by scheduling oral arguments for the week of December 6th.
God damn. You know, and here's the great and terrible thing about this is, and I don't know how the machinations behind this whole thing are playing out. I always assume that there are smoke-filled back rooms filled with, guys named Smitty talking to other guys named Chet, and they're talking about how many points about the VIG and whatever, and there's somebody scratching somebody's back to make things happen at a certain timeline. But part of me wonders, and I'm not even saying it's a conspiracy, I'm just saying it's the natural tendency of people in power to do what it takes to remain in power. Part of me wonders if the appeals for a stay and an injunction and all of these motions, if all of these delaying tactics, because you think that they just want to like get it done, you know, like just screw it, like we're just going to get it all figured out once and for all. I wonder if part of this is being done because they want to push it long enough so that they can then use it as a wedge issue in the 2012 election.
Oh God.
How awesome would that be?
Quite possibly.
Come on. So, I mean, if they can delay this, because we're almost at the end of 2000. I mean, it's August 2010. What's August? We're halfway through August, more than halfway through. So, I mean, we're heading into 2011, which is when the campaigning really starts. It's when, you know, that's when people really start throwing elbows to try to get the nomination. And if they can delay – now, see, now I sound like Ed Rollins. If they can delay a decision on gay marriage until 2011, then it means it can be the first phrase out of Sarah Palin's mouth when she goes out on the stump. And she can say – "And in a country where people oppose gay marriage," you know, and then, you know, and then the crowd, and then it's like the checks just come in. So just like with this mosque thing.
I was going to say, somebody mentioned in the text box, and it's kind of true. It's like, how awesome would it be if they started performing gay marriages at the mosque near Ground Zero?
Dude, I'd get gay married.
The right would just explode.
I would get gay married at that mosque.
They'd all just burst into flames with anger and rage.
If only that wasn't a heresy punishable by eternal damnation, or perhaps a beating. Whatever. You know what it is? Here's the thing about this: is that there's got to be some sort of. I was going to make like a Linux comparison, and somebody would say that that's atheism. I was just going to say that all of the different groups being oppressed right now, and you know, because oppression still goes on across the board. The problem is that none of them are compatible with each other. You know.
Yeah.
Like you think in this case, you think the mosque Islam guys and you think the gays, natural allies against a common enemy. But no. So you it's like you figure at this point that like Gmail and Yahoo could talk to each other. But no. So, blah, 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 blah. All right. Anyway, so this is all true. Here's Dawn Taylor.
Let me do our Geek Watch.
Here's your Geek Watch.
Peek to see if Joseph is here.
Well, why don't you, if I play the open, you want to?
Yeah.
No, okay. So here's your, and I did alert Cheryl to that. I let her know that he was not here yet, and she's attempting to track him down. So I haven't seen anything yet, but we'll figure it out. Here's your Geek Watch for Tuesday right here on the Rick Emerson radio program.
Ugh, this high-speed modem is intolerably slow.
In the Quasar Dilemma, remember you used to...
Just a television show. That's all, okay?
Right, but because we were wondering if the quantum flux... Now, just listen on this.
There is no quantum flux. There's no auxiliary. There's no goddamn ship. You got it?
Energize.
It's going to be one of those things where I'm going to find out that you heard me say something horrid and just decided to cancel his business. By the way, speaking of Oregonian guys, that we should say a couple things. One, first of all, we're lousy with newspaper guys recently, and I mean that in the best way. Yesterday, Ryan White. Today, you know, maybe not. I don't know. It seems like he may be held up somewhere. Joseph Rose. Well, tomorrow, actually, Kelly Clark from Willamette Week. So print. This Thursday, our good friend Peter Carlin will be joining us in the studio at 2 p.m. So that is this Thursday, Mr. Peter Carlin from The Oregonian. And then I believe not next week, but in 2 weeks, I think she's on vacation, Anna Griffin's going to be returning. I sent her an email Well, I thought that this show was like way, way too chaotic, you know. Not too chaotic for her, but just that she was just didn't want any part of her juvenile shenanigans. But amazingly enough, every time I think that our juvenile shenanigans have turned somebody off, that is in fact the thing that they found interesting, and that's why they want to come back. So, you know, I'm just saying, just note to self.
We're like the Chuck E. Cheese of radio.
Exactly. That's exactly what we are. We're, never mind. Skip it. Dumb joke. Forget it. I spared you a pun. Here's Dawn Taylor.
So if you were an obscenely rich, profoundly indolent fanboy,
yes,
what would you choose as the ultimate iPad accessory, Rick Emerson?
All right, hold on a second. Now let's just if I were a rich and what was it? If I was redolent with what?
You're profoundly indolent.
I don't think I know what that word means, which is odd for me.
Sort of lazy and lackadaisical and a layabout.
If I led a sedentary lifestyle?
Yes.
If I was a rich, lazy bastard who was also a fanboy, what would the ultimate iPad accessory or like an application?
Accessory.
It's like a physical thing.
Something
that
to physically use with your iPad.
All right. Is it drawn from? Is it inspired by or drawn from a specific sci-fi franchise?
No. No, it's just.
So it's not like a communicator.
No, it's just merely an elaborate device.
Is it a sex bot attachment of some kind that will massage me?
Not quite, although right. That would be a good idea.
Wait, hold on. Wait. Is it a thing that lets me see stuff on the iPad in 3D?
Close.
Because they ought to do one of those where it's like a layover screen. Okay, let me get one more guess here. Is the accessory itself electronic? In other words, like a screen you just stuck on top of that wouldn't really count. But if it was like a sex bot, that's considered its own device.
I don't think it's actually electronic. It's just...
I give up.
It can be electronic. It is would be the $6,000 Elite Home Theater Seating iPad Chair.
That's dumb.
It's the premium package version of a leather upholstered recliner, an upgrade that adds sound. Yes, it is electric because it adds vibrating sound enhancers, an adjustable headrest, and power assisted reclining. The plain version is merely $2,495.
Okay. All right. I'm sorry. I'll let you continue.
Elite HTS founder and CEO Bobby Balla says, during the design process, our goal was to design a chair that blended the sleek styling of a European sports car with the clean aesthetic of the iPad itself. Tastes, of course, differ on such similarities. There is, here we go. The Elite HTS iPad chair comes equipped with a Luxa 2 H4 iPad holder mounted in one of the chair's two cup holders, allowing you to wield the power of the iPad in total relaxation with both hands free.
And by the way, how telling is it that the chair comes with not one but two cup holders? Because you just can't be bothered sometimes to go get more Fanta from the kitchen.
If you go for the $6,000 premium package, you can choose from 15 different colors of leather, including plum, chocolate, wine, and mocha. The basic model is limited only to black or rustic.
Is there a photo of this?
Yes, there is.
Okay, when you're done, I want to see what this looks like.
The $6,000 version also includes twin low-frequency Crosan TES-100 drivers mounted below the chair's arms to transport you into a visceral experience. You could also choose to install Crestron's Mobile Pro G home control app to your iPad, which will make your iPad chair the command center of your personal fortress, controlling security, entertainment, and environmental options.
Or you could just set fire to all your money while crying and weeping about what a wreck you have made of your life and how you have squandered any hope of human contact. I mean, I'm just saying. No. There's no. I'm looking at the chair right now. No. The only thing that I can see really being usable here, I mean, apart from the cup holders, I suppose. I mean, I like the fact that the chair reclines without me having to do any work. But really, that's not $6,000 worth of convenience. This is like. Don't get me wrong. As it's well established. I mean, there are three Macs within, I don't know, 18 inches of me here. So it's not like I'm opposed to Apple. And you know what? It's America. If somebody will pay you for crap that they don't need, have at it. You know, you get that money. I don't care. I'm just saying this is like the difference between Apple and Microsoft incarnate. You know how much there's an Xbox chair that does, I don't think it has a power recline, but there's an Xbox chair that has the vibrating and the speakers and the thing and the drink holder and the whatever. And I swear to God, it's like $109 or something. I mean, I may be lowballing it a bit, but it ain't no $6,000 chair. I know because my wife was going to buy one until I just – that's the thing where I didn't forbid because, let's be honest, she's really spending her money for about 80% of the things we buy. But I just said now, you might just want to weigh that a bit. And here's how I got her not to buy the Xbox chair, which she wanted for playing. I don't even think it was. It wasn't Catan. It was like for playing Beautiful Katamari or something. She wanted.
She wanted a special Katamari chair.
But it was like, what is even the point of that? Like, what? It's not like when you're firing a gun and you want the cool, you know, sensation of like the recoil of the rifle or whatever. Playing Katamari in the chair would just be weird. I would think it would make you vomit almost immediately. I mean, it would just be like you were on a chair on a that didn't work properly, like with like a leg that was the wrong size or something, and just jittered back and forth all the time. The way I finally got Lara to not buy the Xbox chair is I just said, "Now you know, you're not going to want your friends to see this, right? Like your friends from work, because she has like she has different circles of friends, and she has the you know." She has friends who I think would understand the appeal of an Xbox chair. You would probably understand the appeal of an Xbox chair, Don.
Oh, I do.
I mean, you might not own one, but you get
yeah,
it. You know,
I get
it's
it.
like a special chair. You know, it's like Aaron has special little like lustrous cloth bags for his D20s mm-hmm. or something. You'd get it.
Yeah.
She has some friends that she works with who are all like PhDs, you know, in like something that I can't even pronounce. And I think they would sort of raise an eyebrow and look askance at that. And so the way that I finally got her not to buy is I said, so would you want like, you know, so-and-so like Joyce or whatever from work to see it? And she goes, oh, no, I think she'd think it was silly. And I said, yeah, because, you know, you're going to have to take that upstairs and downstairs like every time they come. You'll have to move. You'll have to unplug it every time they come over. And it's they have to find a place to put it where they're not going to. And she didn't like the idea of having to schlep it all around the house. But again, the chair's like a few hundred dollars, I think. I don't know, it was a $6,000 chair. And that is what Apple is all about. So God bless him.
Well, we'll post a link at some point, but if you, the listener, would like to see actually a video demonstrating the chair, you can go to Elite, HomeTheaterSeating.com, elitehometheaterseating.com/iPad-chair.html.
It allows you to wield the power of the iPad in total relaxation.
Yeah.
Know the glory of not being able to attach anything to your device.
I know, it's like, and really, it's just a really huge chair.
It's got a thing
with
for,
a thing that goes in the cup holder to set your iPad in.
It's basically got a slot for a TV tray in it.
Yeah.
And except instead of a TV, or like one of those things at Cinetopia where the guy brings your mashed potatoes.
All right, there you go. All right.
Although you can get it in Fire Engine Red.
Never before has not being able to take a photograph with your device been so comfortable.
Oh, and there's an illustration on the website that shows how you can feel the bass in your ass. Well, look at the picture. See?
It's just an interesting phrase.
The bass is coming up out of the bottom of the chair, and they show the sound waves that basically are emanating into your butt.
By Grafthar's hammer, by the sons of Warvan, I shall avenge you.
Next. Loneliness and cheeseburgers are a dangerous mix.
By the way, just count it down to like 3, 2, 1 until they'll find videos online of, you know, some chick using it as like a low-rent Sibian or something. So,
a Sibian? I don't know what that is.
Me either.
Did I just...
I don't know
is that,
that
some
is
kind
either.
Of sex thing?
No.
Do I have to go look this up now?
I feel like it might be a show in and of itself, but... why don't we do?
Like, what are the,
let's do one more so that everybody has a chance to savor the glory to come. By the way, I got this from Cheryl. This is about the Joseph Rose from the Oregonian, who is allegedly going to be joining us today, and who is now my sworn enemy. She says, "No answer on cell or at office. Maybe you could call Christy Turnquist and ask her to yell for him in the office. That is really tempting to do. Except we don't know him.
No,
I know her. I know her."
Yeah.
That was a scratch. You were scratching
that
yourself
was, I was
right
scratching
there.
My foot with my other foot, yes.
All right. I know Christy. I don't know Joseph. Who
we
knows?
We know Ryan White. We could ask him to.
He might be short-tempered, though, and have a gun. He does.
Yeah, see, we don't know him. We don't know how testy he might get if we.
It's not like I have a problem calling the Oregonian and have them yell for a guy. I would do that, except I don't know him, and he might not take it in the humorous and Christian spirit.
I could look again to make sure he's not in the kitchen, but it sounds like he's just avoiding us.
I just checked. It was just Carl Weathers again.
Yeah. All right. It's always Carl Weathers.
All right. Well, let's. What are we doing right here? Let's. We did the Geek Watch here. Let's do one more here, and then I will go check to see if he's here. And if not, we're going to assume that we're writing him off for the day,
yeah.
And he'll be dead to me for at least the remainder of today's program. Here's Don Taylor.
More state restrictions on fishing in the Gulf of Mexico were lifted this week, but is the seafood safe to eat, Rick Emerson?
No, it's not, Don Taylor.
Emory University's Dana Boyd Barr says the concerns are more about the long-term effects from eating the seafood rather than the immediate ones.
This is seafood.
Most people won't get sick. I mean, most people won't even notice it's there. And I think it's just time will tell what kind of impact this has had on our seafood and what impact it will have on our health as well.
All right. Those are two different things she just said there. She just said that one is not getting sick. The other is not noticing it's there. Lots of things you don't notice are there, like asbestos, can make you sick. I mean, maybe I don't understand how science works. And in fact, I think it's almost a certainty that I don't. But have there not been stories where they've, like, you know, they found, like, baby whatever, eggs of shrimp or something, and there's, like, oil in them?
Yes.
I mean, it seems like that's a thing your body's not supposed to. You're not supposed to be ingesting crude oil. I don't think I'm going on a limb by saying that. I think that's, like, a given. So how is it that it's not going to make you sick?
Well, Barr says that there's reason to be concerned.
Safe is a relative term.
I'm sorry.
Despite federal assurances.
Safe is a relative term. I mean, they're looking at one health endpoint or one list of chemicals, and they look at that particular health point to determine if something is safe or not. They typically don't look at chronic effects that might occur over time.
Oh, I see. So basically, it's like, does it make you keel over right away? And if it doesn't kill you, if it doesn't kill you like within, like, you know, 6 months or however long the initial study is, then safe. Because they're not... That's exactly how they do it, because then if it causes a chronic illness of disease or it kills you in like 30 years, that's not going to be factored into this. This is like that how they I can talk about this now in the freeing airwaves of the Emerson News Network. It's like my whole life in radio, like about every, I don't know, 6 weeks, some sales guy would come by my desk and he would say, hey, gee, you want to get that that eye surgery done where you don't have to wear your glasses anymore? And I, without even looking, I'd say, no, I don't. Thanks so much. Goodbye now. And he'd say, no. And the deal is, like, they want you to get the surgery and it's free, but you got to pimp it. And I would just say, no, not going to get it now. Not going to get the next time he asked me, you know, go away. And then, like, a few months later, you know, another sales guy or perhaps a new sales guy.
A few years ago, then Daria, you think she got it and then she kept talking about it on the air?
Well, I would imagine. I don't know definitively, but I would say that I will put it this way. I have worked in Portland for... 5 radio corporations in Portland, and at every single radio company, they have approached me, a sales guy's approached me, and different people to say, hey, you want to get the LASIK or the photorefractive keratectomy or the radio keratotomy or whatever, but the deal is... I mean, it's like when I get the hair thing done, when I get the medical hair restoration. I mean, obviously, you know, they cut me a deal on that. But as part of that, it was understood that if I was happy with it in advance and afterward, that I would say, hey, I got this thing done. If you're interested, call this number. Radio stations are approached more than anybody else for the eye thing, which I don't really get. You'd think it would be like TV people, but maybe it's that there are fewer TV hosts in the world, and frankly, they cost more money. It costs more money to advertise on TV. Radio's cheaper. I don't know for sure. I would almost guarantee that if you heard Daria talking about the fact that, well, I got this LASIK and, you know, my vision is really just so much better, I would almost guarantee you money changed hands there, and not in an untoward way. I mean, it was a thing where they came to the station, they paid the station, and then they paid for Daria's surgery, and then she talked about it. That is her eye surgery. That is but a sales guy would come by like every few weeks, and he'd be like, he's like, hey, do you want the LASIK? And I'd be like, no, I don't. And you know, I thought about putting a little sign like the LASIK patient is out. And here's the reason: is because like this seafood thing where she says, you know, well, it's safe if it doesn't kill you right away, but in 10 years. It's because when I'm old enough to remember when I was first in radio, they were trying to get me to have the radio keratotomy, which was then replaced by LASIK, which all that tells me is that they just do crap like immediately as soon as they get the patent for it without trying to figure out if it's actually going to cause your eye to fold in like a party balloon 10 days after the fact, which in fact, it turns out radio keratotomy does sometimes. Because, you know, if you cut slices in a guy's eye, it's not good for it. Does it bother you when I talk about this?
I'm weird about eye things.
Me too. You know what? You know the proof of that? I don't let them cut into my eye with anything.
I can't even. No.
No. And I mean, and don't get me wrong. I know people who've had LASIK done and they're real happy with it. But to me, the potential downside of that is not nearly worth the upside, especially because every time I went to get him the couple of times I would indulge a sales guy and be like, I'll take the meeting. You know, I'm not going to do it. I'm telling you now, but I'll take the meeting. And the LASIK person would all the same thing. Well, you know, how old are you? And I'm saying, well, 35 or whatever. And they say, well, okay, now when you do hit 40, you are going to have to start wearing reading glasses, you know, regardless. And I was like, so I'm having you laser off part of my eye so that I have 5 years of not wearing glasses. Thank you, no. For a surgery that replaced something you were trying to get me to get 10 years ago that you don't do anymore because it's so dangerous. So,
yeah.
No.
I have a similar reaction to, like, when my dog when we try to trim her toenails and she has, like, a mini nervous breakdown and freaks out. It's like, don't touch my feet!
Yeah.
And I'm like that about eyes. Like, when I go to the eye guy, they do that thing where they blow the air into your eyeball.
See, but...
And I swear to God, it's everything I can do to not just leap out of the chair and, like, cling to the ceiling like a cartoon cat.
I'm not trying to further unnerve you. Can we talk about that thing for a second? The puff of air into your eye thing?
Sure.
You know, just tell him not to do it.
I guess I could. I know.
I don't understand why people don't just say no. No, I'm going to skip that because you know it's America.
They can't
force you to have a medical procedure.
Yeah, but I also know that it's not going to actually hurt me, and I think I just feel like I'm a big baby because I can't stand it.
No, nobody likes it. Just tell him not to do it. That's what I do.
Oh.
And
I'll tell you that it never occurred to me because it's just like, oh, it's part of the thing.
No,
of going
it's because, well, you know why? It's because it is ingrained in you in America, A, that doctors are like godlike authority figures. And it's a kid thing, too, because it's an authority figure telling you to do something medical and you figure it must be necessary.
Now, I don't have that thing about doctors. My mother was a nurse and my father, you know, was a fireman, but then he was a paramedic. And I've been around and I worked in a hospital for a while. I've been around medical people. I don't have this. You know, weird.
It just never occurred to you, though, to say no.
It's just with the eye doctor. It's like, you know, we do this and we do that, and then we do this check for glaucoma. It's like, oh, I hate that part. Ah! But I just go along.
No, and you don't need to be. And there's no need to be rude about it because it's.
That's true.
I'm
just paying them $35 for a damn eye exam so I can get my glasses.
That's the thing, and I'm not.
I don't have to put up with having stuff blown in my eyes.
And you know what? And I'm not saying I'm smarter than anybody else because it didn't occur to me for a long time either. But then one day I was just sitting there in the waiting room, and somebody was bitching to somebody else. They're like, they're going to do that thing where they puff me in the eye, I've spent most of my life without insurance. I'm fortunate that I have insurance now. But you're still paying for it. You know, still paying something.
Yeah.
And I just cut them a check. And I remember thinking, well hold on now. Well, this is still, at the moment anyway, this is still a relatively free country. They can't force me. I mean, they can't force you to take a 5-pound tumor off your kid's face. They can't force you to get blood if you're bleeding to death. And I thought, well, they can't force me to have any sort of medical procedure. What would happen if I just say no? And I went in there, and the woman said, okay, we're going to have you step up to this machine, and you're going to feel a little puff. And I said, I'm not going to do that today. Mm-hmm. And it was the thing where you can tell that, and this is where the authority thing comes in, you can tell that they're not used to people. And I was very polite about it, but you can tell they're not used to people saying no to them. Because I do think that there are people in, and it's never the doctors themselves; it's always the flunkies, where they get like ancillary power. You know, they get like the reflected power. And occasionally, when I say it, someone will like arch an eyebrow at me, like they're not used to anybody talking back. But I just said, you know, I'm not going to do that today. And she said, well, it's for glaucoma, which is like, you know, for like when you're like 100.
Yeah.
And I said, well, you know, be that as it may, I'm going to skip that today. And she went, okay, next up. And so here's it.
And I actually asked about the glaucoma the last time I was in there because my mother developed glaucoma, but she didn't get it until she was like almost 70. And so Tanya said, should I have to worry about this? Because, you know, my mother did develop glaucoma. And they went, well, old was she when she got it? I said, like in her late 60s. She's like, you're fine.
No, again, so just FYI from me to everybody else. Maybe we can start some sort of, I should make a viral video about this so it can become a thing that so we can throw off the shackles of the puff of air. because again, it's so obvious, but it never occurs to people.
My big breakthrough was when I realized that I didn't have to actually get undressed all the way every time I went to the doctor, even though they told me to.
Tell them to get bent.
Because I hate it. I hate it.
Yeah.
And that little paper thing, I hate it. And I realized once, like, I'm coming in here to have my throat looked at.
It's not.
No, I'm not taking my damn clothes off.
It's not just that. People can make all the cracks they want about, you know, socialism. This is a capitalist society, and at a hospital, you are a paying customer.
That's right.
And you know what? Somebody's paying them even if you're not. Even if it's your insurance company or, you know, if it's the man paying them or whatever. It doesn't matter. You're a paying customer. They tell you to take off your pants. Say, you take off your pants, Johnny, and then I'll take off mine. So when they tell you to get the puff of thing in your eye, just say no. And FYI, final thing, if you are afeard of the glaucoma, here's the other thing they won't tell you. Now I sound like Kevin Trudeau, except I'm not a felon. Here's the other thing, is they won't tell you that there is actually another test they can do for glaucoma, and they have the thing right there to do it. And it doesn't involve puffing anything into your eye. There is a completely painless test for glaucoma they can do where you don't feel a single thing at all, and it's just as accurate. You know why they don't do it? Because it takes them three steps to set it up instead of just one. So there you go. You be polite about it, but just tell them you're not going to get air puffed in your eye. And think of how liberating it is right now that I'm giving. This is worth your 32. This is worth like the $80 if you bought an annual thing, or you know your $6.99 a month. You after today need never again have air puffed into your eye by the thing. Rick Emerson has set you free.
By the way, I should have probably recognized that this would happen, but. The text box is all lit up with people explaining to me what the Sibian was.
Yeah.
With links I could click on if I so chose, which I did not.
You got to do it. No, you got to do it tomorrow. When Kelly Clark is here. I got a long story about the Sibian, and it's not a story that anybody probably thinks. Not what you think it is. I got a long, long story. Not long. I have an interesting story from a long time ago. About the Sibian before it went sort of mainstream, but that thing is fascinating. It really is, and there's a male equivalent of that thing too. It's awesome. It really is like that is technology being put toward its fullest fulfillment. So it's I'll just put it this way. I will say this, and I hope I still have
it.
Is this
like the Warhammer thing that moves and it has a
Warhammer?
I don't know what it was called. The something hammer that it had, the pleasure hammer, the happy hammer that has like some kind of pneumatic device that and moving parts.
You know, if that's Warhammer, then Things from Another World is a much more exciting store than I gave them credit for. Warhammer's a role-playing game, I believe. You're talking about the pneumatic, it's a wanking thing, but it's electronic. Yeah, it is that.
Kind
no,
of
it's that.
A chair that yeah. with okay. the thing and the stuff.
Here's a true story, and
I've never actually seen one in action. I just heard about them.
Here's why you're lucky you know me. how will this story end? I won't tell the story. I will just say this for now, because we don't have time to get into it today. And this was in Salt Lake City, of all places, when I was working at a talk radio station there. You've worked in newspapers and media where they send you like CDs and gigaws and tchotchkes and like press releases and like, here's a copy of our movie. Will you please watch it and review it? Or here's like a panda bear to promote our new, you know, Ice Age 5 movie. Mm-hmm. I got an envelope from a public relations company when I was living in Utah in 1996. I was like, well, what can this be? And I opened it, and I don't know if they just sent this to everybody or they singled me out. And it is a promotional VHS tape. It is a promotional tape from the company that manufactures both the Sibian and the hell is the other thing called? We all just call it the wanking machine. but it's – I forget. There's actually a name for it. And it is a – it looks like one of those vacuum things from the bank that you put in the tube and it goes – except it's hooked to a thing that
Don't
looks
– ever make that sound again.
It's like one of those things with a length of rubber hose and it's hooked to what looks like a it's hooked to what looks like a suitcase. That's the sort of generator. And the man
I was imagining an old-fashioned canister vacuum cleaner.
And it they sent me, unsolicited, at the radio station in Salt Lake City, a videotape from the company that makes the Sibian and the other thing. And it's about an hour long. And it's like 15 minutes of explanation of each and then 15 minutes of showing how to use it. And it is like full – and it's not done with it. It's like CGI or like a mannequin. It's like a guy saying like, and as you can see, I am more or less fully aroused now and I'm going to place the canister – if I got rid of that thing, I'll kill myself. It's got to be in my garage at home. It must be at home.
You have to dub that.
It's
over
one of
too.
My most
like burn that on desk or something.
It's one of my most valued possessions. I used to bring that out at parties. I'd be like, "Hey, everybody's really drunk. Watch this," and I put it in. And it was before it became really mainstream because the Sibian, especially in online porn, I think has started to appear a lot because it's like a weird for people because it's a strange sort of like mechanical fetish and it's like watching chicks kind of get off themselves, but not really. And I think Howard actually has. I think Stern has one in the studio that he occasionally would make like some porn chick ride or whatever. But we didn't know about it then. It was like 1996, and it's like basically some chick sitting on a pommel horse that has a dildo stuck in the middle of it. And it goes up to like 9 jillion RPMs a second or whatever. And it rotates and it bobs and weaves and it does something else. And, you know, and it frappes. And
And the best part, now I'm just giving it all away, but the best part of the video, I really ought to upload this, and this is to charge people extra. Why should I make this like a Rick Emerson Gold membership to watch this? But the best part is they're talking about, you know, like, you know, the obviously satisfying your partner comes first. But if you're in a healthy relationship but just need a little extra spice or whatever, and clearly, you know, whatever. But it, so they show this guy who clearly cannot please his wife. That's the subtext. And his wife is just sitting there, and as Sam Kinison would say, effing a lawnmower in the middle of the living room. You know, she's riding the Sibian thing, and the guy is relegated to, like, cupping one of her breasts, you know, or whatever, and just looking sad. While his wife is pleasured by a thing that, I swear to God, like thrusts and vibrates like 9,000 times a minute. And then he's busy trying to feel like a man, you know, which is not ever going to be possible again. So I got the whole video tab. I'll bring it in. We'll get popcorn. It's got to be at home. I swear to God.
You bring that in when you bring the chocolate-covered peanut butter bugles that you promised me.
I cannot imagine why I ever would have gotten rid of that, because it's gold. It is just – it's full-on gold. I had to give it to those film festival guys, the found footage guys. All right. Well, let's do this. We'll take a little break, come back on the other side. We'll do some more news. We got the penis, strangely enough, penis watch still on the way, and so forth. All right, Don, we'll make it ladies' choice here. Do you wish to have contemporary but classic rock feeling song, amusing, wry, self-deprecating rock, or lovable alt-rock?
The first one.
All right, that is this. All right, ladies and gentlemen, the Rick Emerson Show continues next right here on the Emerson News Network. Don't go anywhere. Penis Watch still to come, and so forth. You stay right there. It's Tom Petty.
Just say
Lenny D, by the way, somebody, and that's not Lenny D like DiMaggio, like short for something. Lenny D, D-E-E is his name. You had asked about this, I think. You'd asked, you said, like, who is this delightful fellow playing the organ here? So this is Lenny D. All of his, by the way, this guy, I have all of his, I'm not going to say I have all of his records. I have all of his records that I can find. Every time I find a Lenny D record somewhere that's almost on vinyl, like at a swap meet, I buy it. And then this is off, this one isn't off vinyl, I think this is off his, they remastered, he put it like a double, like a two CD collection of this. And it's like, how many people could, I can't even remember how many of those they made, how many of these think they're going to sell? And it's like 55 of this guy's songs, and they're all just basically this. And I bought it, like, without even looking at the price. I was like, I'm purchasing that right now. He just died like a year and a half ago, so I missed my chance to interview him, unfortunately. So I am, you know what I'll do someday? I'll bring in some Lenny D, you know, like just a whole bunch of his stuff. Because he covered some contemporary, like some standards. And then he did some of his original stuff, too. And we'll just make it a whole day of Lenny D. Because he's fantastic. I really dig this music. I had some point I was going to make. Oh, and his name, his albums are all called, like, Delightful and, you know, Delicious and you know, whatever. It's like a Cole Porter sort of
decomposing.
Thing.
Decomposing.
Thank you. Anywho, so, when you hear this music, you sort of, you know, this is a time to talk about one of our fine advertisers. But, you know, and look, I'm not saying that the cleaning solution isn't going to come to your house and clean, do a great job. They will. But you got, you know, carpet, rug, upholstery, tile, whatever. You know, it's gotten all scrungy. You need it to be cleaned. Or you just want to keep, you know, how about this? You just put in brand new carpet, you know, or you just got brand new tile put down. And you're like, you know, F this. Remember when we came in last night and we moved into this house and the carpet was all gross and we just got brand new tile? Like my friends Dave and Sarah, they just moved into a new place. I was there this weekend and they just redid the living room. They put in brand new tile, brand new carpet, whatever. And she's like, you should have seen this place when we moved in. It was just, it was you know, the carpet, you know, was 20 years old and the tile had never been cleaned. And, you know, we're keeping this place looking immaculate. That's another thing you do. You call the cleaning solution. Michael Beatty is the guy's name, 971-533-3211. And so, you know, maybe you're a pristine person. Maybe you just redid the entire place. Or, you know, maybe you're just, you know, you're tired of keeping it clean yourself. But you're not going to let it get dirty in the first place. You just want to keep it looking good. You call him, he can put you on a maintenance program. And here's the thing about that. It actually benefits you to do that because having him come and just maintain your carpet, like looking clean or your tile or whatever it is, and just keep it looking the way it is, that's like 40% of what it's going to cost to actually have it cleaned. So if you've got something you just put down, you've just had a room redone, don't wait for it to become just foul and then you get it cleaned and then, you know, don't be like a guy where you let the house get filthy while your wife is out of town. Theoretically, and then on the night that she comes back, like you go through like a whirling dervish and clean the whole place. Just keep it looking good, like from the beginning. 971-533-3211. The cleaning solution and the person of Michael Beatty, one of the people who makes the Rick Emerson Show and the Emerson News Network possible at the low, low cost of only 32 cents a day. 971-533-3211. This is the Rick Emerson Show on the Emerson News Network. And it is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. It's 503-502. Is that right? That's wrong. I've been giving out the number for weeks now. 502. It's not 502 anything. 503-505-6964. 503-505-6964. 505-6964. Don't forget, tomorrow we'll be joined by Kelly Clark. I swear to God, she's going to talk about kombucha.
She'll actually be here, though.
Yes, she will be here. Well, I say now, tempting fate. She's going to talk about kombucha. I don't know why. I mean, I kind of know why. She doesn't drink it, I don't think.
I've never actually tasted it because it frightens me.
Because it's made of mold?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You don't want to drink that. I got a house full of it if you ever want some, though. Let's see. On Thursday, Mr. Peter Carlin from The Oregonian. And on Friday, Brett Burmeister. And he writes a whole blog about Portland food carts. He'll be with us. So I got to make him bring us some food.
Speaking of food carts, by the way, I thought I'd mention that tomorrow is Third Wednesday, and the third Wednesday of each month, a number of food carts give their proceeds for the day to a worthy charity. And tomorrow, if you eat at Big Ass Sandwiches, The Big Egg, Whiffy's, Kettle Kitchen, Wet Hot Beef, Ninja Plate, Allie's Kitchen, give pizza a chance, or Built to Grill, all the proceeds will benefit Planned Parenthood of Oregon. So you can go to a food cart and do something good for the world at the same time.
I'd like to put forth right now that we don't ever mention Wet Hot Beef again.
Okay.
That's just...
That's not a good name.
No,
that
it's not.
That is not an appetizing name
and the
at
thing
all.
Is, that's the thing is, it's not even like it's too edgy or something. It takes away my appetite almost immediately.
No, that's like those Carl's Jr. commercials where everything's just dripping like a severed carotid artery or something. And it's just, and you go, this doesn't make me want food. It makes me queasy.
No, yeah, I don't want this. So just confidential to whoever owns that joint. You've chosen poorly.
And their food might be delicious.
But I'll never know.
The name is. But at any rate, if you go to any of those places.
We, of course, strongly recommend going to Big Ass Sandwiches.
Yes.
And just because they're pals and they're great folks. So, and I saw Lisa and Brian. They were here last, I guess, Friday. They were on with Sarah and Greg from Unemployment Radio. We got to get them in here.
Yes. Yes, we do.
Which is really just so they'll bring us food. And also because they're great, but also food.
But like you said, though, when we have Brett Burmeister in on Friday and he talks about food carts,
Let's be prepared.
Suggest to him that he bring us some samples of different foods that we can try.
Well, and let's be prepared with food because, you know, we do this thing, and this happens in Outlook Portland all the time, too, where we will be talking about a food-oriented topic, but then we always forget that we get, like, ravenously hungry about 20 minutes into the show, and then there's, like, no food to be had. So, there you go. Without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, this is Dawn Taylor.
And now, from the news desk, this is Dawn Taylor.
A group of hikers from Geneva, Illinois, had to be rescued from Cedar Lake three times over the weekend. According to the Jackson County Sheriff's Office, a man called around 5:30 p.m. on Friday, August 13th, saying he and a friend were lost on a trail. The caller told dispatch that they had no water and couldn't move forward. Sheriff's deputies and some local fishermen found the two men around 7:30 Friday night. During the initial search, deputies also found two other hikers near the spillway. According to the department, rescue crews took all four people back to their vehicle after they refused treatment. The next day, the sheriff's department said the group called them again, asking for help getting back to their campsite. A deputy helped them get back to their campsite and left. According to the sheriff's department, a short time later, the group called them a third time, saying they were in need of water and couldn't make it back to their vehicle. A rescue boat found them and again helped them to their car.
You know, I hope that they took a little bit longer every time, or that each time they rescued them, they made them do something demeaning.
Or that third time,
bark like a dog.
That third time, they just fined them. They just said, "Yes, we will help you, but it's going to cost you $300."
Now, do they not already? Does the state charge you if they have to come rescue your stupid ass off a mountain or something?
I know. I think Oregon does, depending on the situation.
I mean, you know, if it's obviously just your own fault and you're just a jackass, it seems like that you ought to get a bill for that, because otherwise I'm paying for it.
It has happened that, I don't know, I think if it's a false alarm, obviously you have to pay for everything and there's possible jail time or something, but I'm not sure. I don't know. You have to pay for anything if you're rescued, like, say, off the side of Mount Hood or something.
They really ought to. That is, I would be wholeheartedly in favor of that.
I know that those Life Flight helicopters ain't cheap, and most people's insurance doesn't actually cover that.
That's interesting a little bit after, though, because presumably that's a thing you need to save your life.
Same as an ambulance, though. There are insurance companies that will only pay for an ambulance if you call ahead and get them to approve it.
Really? I've been shot. Could I get you to approve it? Really?
Yeah.
All right. Well,
That's I don't even part know, of why we're trying to get some health care reform in this country, Mr. Emerson.
Yeah, you let me know when that happens. Yeah. You let me know when that takes care. You know, no disagreement from me. And let me just note, by the way, here's the great thing about the Emerson News Network. I mean, apart from like everything, apart from like this email where it says it took 5 seconds to get one of these. Worth the subscription price, is the subject line. Rick, I am free. You have set me in every single glasses slash contact lens wearing person free because no one likes the glaucoma test. Worth my subscription price right there. Okay, here's how you can pay me back, figuratively. You should then pass the word of how the Rick Emerson Show has freed you from the bonds of ocular slavery like everybody you know.
And buy a gift certificate for a loved one.
Or just send me $10. I'd take that. What was I going to say? The other great thing about the Emerson News Network is now I can do that smug, self-righteous thing of saying, well, look, I really do support national health care reform, and that's coming from a business owner. Yeah, I can see. The thing is, I can lecture my tedious nutcase Fox News watching relatives, and I can say, well, look, as a small business owner, let me tell you a few things. And then I could just spout a bunch of, like, liberal, stuff that will just debug the hell out of them. And it's like, what are they going to do? Because I'm a proud capitalist, and so I can just say, as a capitalist, you're dumb.
So does that mean you're going to start providing me with health care?
No, of course not.
I'm going to get insurance out of
this? No, you fool. Keep that talk up. I won't let you form that union you've been talking about either. Come in here, Timmy Ryan will be sitting in that chair.
Oh, and the audience would
I just say that to rile the audience up, actually. Yeah. It's almost too easy. I just go to Timmy Ryan, and it's just everything. Although, you know what's weird about that is, and I haven't heard anything more about him moving back to Portland, so everybody can breathe easy. It looks like your long national nightmare will not be recurring, and I don't think he's coming back. But what's weird is when I just was that one day where I was, I guess, half joking about talking about, Timmy Ryan, I'm going to give him a joke, and everybody went nuts. And then it was like for every five emails that were like death to Timmy Ryan, I'd be going like, he seems like a fine young lad. I enjoyed his sense of humor. I don't listen to the naysayers. So there you go. So I've managed to annoy everybody because it doesn't look like he's coming back anyway. Here's Don Taylor.
Let's do our penis watch.
Let's, shall we? Here's your, what the hell did I, where is that? Here we go. Here's your penis
Take
watch
a look
for
at
Tuesday.
My enormous penis. My troubles start a melting away. Bow, bow, I take bow, a look at my enormous penis. And everything is going my way.
Here is Don Taylor with your penis watch for Tuesday.
Cortez R. Moorman, 25, is facing 5 charges connected to a report of attempted rape Sunday in Jackson County, Kansas City. That's where it is. Kansas City. According to the probable cause statement, Moorman allegedly offered a ride to a woman and later tried to force her into sex. The victim says she fought with Moorman and was dragged back to his car before she eventually escaped and waved down a passing police officer. Moorman has denied attacking the woman and denied even being inside the car. He says he was walking to a gas station to buy cigarettes. The probable cause includes this aside from the police report. While sitting in the interview room, Moorman moved his chair to block the door, removed his penis, and began masturbating.
Ah.
When he was asked to stop, he moved his chair against the wall and began fondling himself under his clothing. Moorman repeated the same behavior while sitting in the room alone at the conclusion of the interview at the police station.
Friend, I don't even know where to go with that. I just, this is a
guys,
whole...
denying the allegation of attempted rape, but then starts masturbating.
Are you saying I have a sexual compulsion of some kind? Hold on a second. Is there a photo as well?
There's a photo of him.
That's great. Now that image will be in my head. Thanks so much. It's the whole world of broken people walking around out there. You know what I mean? It's like the island of misfit felonious toys. God damn. This is a completely broken society. All right, there's your penis
Take
watch.
Take a look at my enormous penis. And my troubles start a-melting away. I take a look at my enormous penis. And everything is going my way.
Bow, bow, bow. All right. Well, let's do a couple more, and then we will wrap things up here for the day. Don't forget, coming up tomorrow, Ms. Kelly Clark from Willamette Week will be here Thursday. Peter Carlin Friday. Brett Burmeister, who is a food carts blogger in Portland. It seems like there was something else coming up. There was something else that we were going to be doing later on the week. Oh, well, I'm going to look for the video of the wanking machine. And then, which, and you talk about it being a different time. This is how much a different time it was. And how, you know, you'll hear guys of a certain age go, well, back when I was too young and stupid, too young to know any better, that was really the definition of, that was how I behaved. Not like I'm much different now, but that was how I really behaved then. Because even in Salt Lake City, sometimes you look back and go, what the hell? I have no idea why they didn't fire me more often than they did. Sometimes I think that. Because even like in a pre-Janet Jackson's boob era, even when the fines were only $33,000 per incident, not $325,000, even when the fine was only $33,000, I don't know what was going on in my head. Where I did an afternoon talk show, not too terribly dissimilar from this one. We had a whole thing where we like played the audio from the wanking machine like promotional video, you know, where there's like a guy, you know, like getting it on with like a vacuum suck thing. And I don't know why it occurred to me that that was a thing I could play on the air. And amazingly, like, no complaints. Not a single complaint. Maybe because I guess in Salt Lake, you know, those folks weren't listening to begin with. But who knows? I have no idea, you know, like, why I thought that was an okay thing to do. But, you know, anyway, so if I can find that, we'll play it. Here's Don Taylor. Well, what do I care? You know, I'm just saying. That was then. This is now. Here's Don Taylor at the news desk.
Actress Miley Cyrus has taken her share of shots from the media, but her tough-mindedness partly comes from having dad Billy Ray Cyrus as her mentor. For years, the country singer was known to millions as the mullet-haired singer with a catchy hit single. Miley, whose movie The Last Song comes out next week on Blu-ray, talked to us about being influenced by her father.
Before I play that, what do you know about what is the movie?
The Last Song, I think...
I don't even know what that is.
I think it's the one that was written by Nicholas Sparks.
Really?
Yeah, and it and starred Miley Cyrus. Yeah.
Nicholas Sparks, that's weird.
Yeah.
All right, well, fair enough. Okay, so there's Miley Cyrus.
I think it's cool because my dad, he...
I have another cigarette, Miley. For the love of Christ. See, you go that way, the sheep. Are you going sheep?
I can't make a horse noise.
Yeah, see, to me, she sounds like she ought to be like serving up my flapjacks in a Waffle House somewhere. You know what I mean?
It's amazing. Every time I look at her, you wouldn't think someone could be pudding faced and horse faced at the same time, and yet she manages to achieve that.
What is pudding faced?
You know, like
I don't even know what that means. I have no, like, I know it's not a compliment, but I mean. Like, horse-faced, I get what that means. Like, prominent teeth, big jaw, whatever. Pudding-faced, I don't even know.
Like, what's his name, Bass, from NSYNC?
Lance Bass.
Lance Bass.
I don't know what that means with him either. Does it mean he's jowly?
Yeah, kind of. It's kind of like, it's not even really jowly. Just like, I don't know. Pudding-faced to me just means that sort of just round, squishy face.
Okay, so like a fat face, maybe disproportionately so.
Yeah, just kind of a...
Without definition.
She is just a strange-looking person. Just a weird, creepy-looking person.
Okay. Let's just...
I think it's cool because my dad, he has been, you know, doing this. He's been knocked down so many times. He's had so many, like, so much drama and stuff that he's, like, you know, been hurt or felt betrayed by a music industry or, you know, whatever. But he still, every time he sings, he's doing it because he loves it and not for any political reason or for any other thing. He's like, I'm making albums now because I like it. If one person buys it and one person likes it, I'm happy. He's like, you know, one in a million people may, you know, like it. But he's like, I made it and I said something honest. So I like working with people that are honest about their music.
Here's the thing about, what is she going to sound like when she's 50? I mean, only...
Kathleen Turner.
I was going to say only...
Harvey Fierstein.
This is the voice that only pachyderms will be able to hear. I mean, it's good. At Kathleen Turner's, hey, what I saw on the Facebook. Hold on a second. Speaking of Kathleen Turner, and I will tie this all together. Let's see if I can find this here. This is I believe our good friend Jenny put this up on my Facebook thing yesterday. She was talking about she says, hey, I'm probably one of the last five people on earth to still watch Entourage. Carrie Fisher had a cameo on there Sunday night. Let me just tell you, she's dangerously close to Kathleen Turner territory. She was unrecognizable and so, so, so mannish. And I haven't seen... I'm trying to think of the last time I saw Carrie Fisher, you know, in something... Like, the most recent time she was on film and I saw it, and I can't even remember what it would have been. I don't remember the last time I saw her on camera.
She was on 30 Rock, like, last season.
See, and I'm so far behind on that show that I don't even, yeah, I got nothing. But, I mean, did you ever see the Kathleen Turner stuff on Californication?
No.
It was unreal.
No.
I mean, season three sucks, but, and she's a, and she doesn't help out. Her character is, you know, it's just, she doesn't really bring much to that show. And I know she did the thing on Friends, and I don't know how it is compared to the thing on Friends, but I mean, it's like, it's like Merlin Olsen in a dress. I mean, it's unreal. So if Carrie Fisher, how sad that Carrie Fisher might have become that way. How cruel.
Well, Carrie Fisher is just, I mean, Carrie Fisher's, you know, pushing 60.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean you have to turn into Burl Ives.
And she's, you know, and she's a little on the heavy set side. And yeah, but it's like, yeah, as she's gotten older, her voice has gotten deeper.
That's the thing.
Deeper, and, you know,
older doesn't mean manny,
though. Yeah, but
you
can't really help that, can you?
Turning man-like?
Well, you can't help if the timbre of your voice just keeps getting lower with age.
I thought that the timbre of your voice got higher. It's why old women all have, like, the screechy voices, you know?
Well, I don't think it's the same for everyone, obviously. Or Kathleen Turner would not sound like Ernest Borgnine.
Well, but see, don't you wonder – here's the thing. But don't you wonder about Kathleen Turner if there is some weird, like, thing going on there? Like, did she have
– I know she had some kind of an illness,
well,
but I thought it was,
I mean,
like, arthritis or something.
Well, I don't know. But, I mean, it doesn't say – it's like – because here's the thing. Because I'll say this, and then they'll say, like, that she had adenoidal cancer or something. So, you know, who's to say? I mean, like, I went to school with a guy – I won't mention his name, but I went to school with a guy who had not adenoid, but he had like a throat infection when he was a kid. When he was a baby. He was like the flu, and you know, or like a cold, pneumonia or something. But it went. He was just like a horrible cold that he got when he was very young and had a very weak immune system. And it actually he recovered fully from this influenza or whatever it was, but it was actually such a virulent strain of it, and he was a baby, and it actually. It did, I don't know if it damaged them, but it altered his vocal cords. And I think the deal is, I think that it actually stunted the development of his vocal cords. And he could speak properly, but his voice was unreal in terms of lowness. And I don't mean like he had a sexy, like, I'm your smooth lover man voice. I mean, like, it sounded like he was a record on half speed. It was creepy. And to his credit, he wasn't a creepy guy because he compensated for it by being a very ebullient person. But he had it was like a medically low voice. It was bizarre.
Well, you made a joke about Miley and smoking earlier, and that does have an effect. I mean, my mother started smoking when she was like 12 or 13, and she only gave it up like a few years before she died in her late 60s. And her voice, just as the years went on, just got lower and lower and lower.
That's true.
To the point where she was, you know, imagine my mother physically kind of looked like sort of a cross between, particularly when she got older, cross between like Anne B. Davis and Betty White. But she had this voice like B. Arthur. You know, and I think it was just from smoking for 50 years.
I guess, well, like Lauren Bacall had that too, and she was a chain smoker, so I guess that makes sense. Boy, you know, but back on Billy Ray Cyrus for a second. How lucky do you think that guy feels? I mean, that's a guy who won the lottery twice. He must just wake up every day and just kiss the golden ass of whatever statue he worships, whatever god you know is understood to him, because he had. And subject for another time. I have always said, and I will always think, I think Billy Ray Cyrus, not that anybody's crying tears for him at this point, I think he gets a bad rap. I think that he is unfairly maligned, and it kind of became a punchline, like way out of proportion to what he deserved.
Well, didn't Achy Breaky Heart sound remarkably like the Hokey Pokey?
Yeah, well, maybe, I suppose. I have a Johnny Cash song that he did on that big Rick Rubin comeback album, American Recording. I swear to God, sounds just like She'll Be Coming Around the Mountain When She Comes. It's like a dead ringer for that. So I think Billy Ray Cyrus, you know, got a bad rap in a lot of ways. But then that's neither here nor there. He had a whole thing, you know, flash in the pan. And then, you know, and I don't know if he saved his money or not, but I know that he was famous and, you know, and on the cover of everything. And then had that Vanilla Ice thing happen where it's not that he just faded from favor. He just became a punchline, became a laughing stock. And then, like, amazingly, like the lightning in the bottle again, where his daughter becomes the biggest thing on earth. And that guy must just be going, like, thank Christ.
And he gets himself cast on her TV show as her dad.
And not only that, he gets himself. What does he do with her mom? Where's the mom at?
Yeah.
All right. Well, a truck stop somewhere. So he gets himself cast as the dad. So he, A, has the huge country rock success early on. B, has the famous daughter, so that's money in the bank because she's not 18 yet. Mm-hmm. C is a producer on that show, so that's more money for him and him alone. D gets to now be a television star by acting as her dad. E gets all the hot babe action from being a stable single father who's looking out for his girl. F, now everybody in the world, like, kisses his ass because he's done such a great job as a single dad with this girl that America loves. And so, like, all of his past laughingstock stuff erased. Yeah. And so now when he's on a show, he'll make fun of the mullet. He'll make, like, a mullet joke himself. And you can care. It's because he knows that it doesn't matter. It's all his sins of the past have been expunged by the glory of his daughter. So that guy is lucky.
Although she says that he just makes records for the love of the music.
The
and that if he only sells one record, then he doesn't care. I don't believe that. I think that if he only sold one record, he would be very sad.
He'd be annoyed. I think
it would bother him quite a lot.
I wonder if you sold one record. If you were a guy who released a record, what was that? Who was that band? There was some band, and it wasn't one record, but there was some famous example of a band that literally, it's like they sold. Well, I'll give you another. This isn't the one I'm thinking of, but you remember the hip hop collective Arrested Development? They did that song Tennessee.
Oh,
Take me to another place. So, you know, they had this, whatever that album was, like 9 years, 5 days, and whatever in the life of. And it was big, you know, crossover hit, and every college, you know, people who now listen to Dave Matthews then listened to Arrested Development. Every college kid went on Arrested Development. And then they had their follow-up record, which was called, anyone? Anyone? Don Taylor?
No, I don't even know the
Zingalamaduni. And so Zingalamaduni, I swear to Christ, that's the name of their follow-up record. Zingalamaduni.
There were no marketing people involved with this, were
no,
there?
No, no. And there were no accountants with that band. Nobody in that band thought to call, like, H&R Block and go, should we have 75 people in this group, most of whom don't do anything? What about this old guy who just stands on stage and holds a gourd? Do we have to pay him? Yeah? Ah, crap. But they had this album, Zingalamaduni, which is their follow-up. Now, their first record sold, I mean, it was like 7 million copies. The second record, I swear to Christ, it sold like 5,000 copies. It's like an off the charts fall off. I mean, it's like maybe unparalleled, you know, in terms of album number one to album number two. If you sold one album, let's say you're Billy Ray Cyrus and you release a record and it literally sells one copy, not including comps and review copies, one guy goes and he pays full price. Would you actually would you buy a plane ticket and go to that guy's house and just thank
yeah,
him? You just say, go, hey, thanks, pal. I appreciate it. Can I just tell you this? You know, I can talk about this now because we're not on CBS. We're on the Emerson News Network. You know, I have this the whole side band of the Wonderstrucks and whatever. And, you know, I get a little sales report every now and again that, like, you know, you've sold 4 cents worth of music to so-and-so. And, you know, I don't really sell albums all that much. It's typically people and they buy singles or whatever on iTunes where there's just, like, no money to be made. But every now and again, it'll be like, you've sold an album. You know, you've sold one copy of your CD in American Education 2. I sold one to some guy in Madrid like 2 weeks ago. So, like, I got a little thing, like, you've sold. And I was like, oh, is it a say? Because that Geek Like Me song sells, you know, in a lot of places. But it was like, you've sold an entire album. And it was like the guy's name. And it was, you know, some Spanish name. And it was like in blah, 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 you know, gave this or that in Madrid. And it was weird. Like, I almost – so, like, Lara's going to Madrid in October. And I'm thinking about having her stop by the guy's house and just thank him. You know, or just, like, leave a note in his mailbox. You know, yeah. Rick Emerson wants to thank you for buying his Wonderstruck record because she's going to be in Madrid. And it's like, I know it's a big city, but I mean, you know, she's going to be there. So how weird is that, though? It's just a strange thing.
That is strange.
I wonder if he speaks English because I want to just email him and go, like, what is your deal? Like, why? Thank you. But I mean, what? You know, it's odd.
I get every once in a while I'll get somebody who'll like friend me on Facebook or do something. I look at them to see why. And I can't figure out like why. It's like some guy in Spain or something, and I don't know, other than like with Twitter I can kind of understand it because I'm a writer for Cinematical, and under the Meet the Team section my Twitter thing is there, but with Facebook it's like, how did you stumble across me and why?
why
me?
Hey, you guys ought to put together a cooking group called Team the Meat. Hey now. Sorry.
You mentioned Dave Matthews, by the way. I was going to say that, you know, your irrational dislike of Steely Dan.
Yeah.
It just makes you go kind of fly off the handle.
Dave Matthews? Right.
Not me, my husband.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, just even the mention of the name Dave Matthews, and he just kind of, you can see him just shudder and start to kind of twitch.
I hate that guy.
And if the music is playing, he will leap up and silence it immediately.
I hate Dave Matthews. It was all I could do to make it through that episode of House where he played like a retard who could play piano. It was just torture. And I kept praying like for his character to die just so I could just like proxy appreciate that. You know, it's just here's the thing about, and we have to quit. But yeah. I mean, we don't have to. But I mean, it's just otherwise it's going to be here like 7 o'clock. The thing about Dave Matthews, he's just so bland. That's the thing. It's like I can forgive almost anything, but there's just nothing interesting about his music. And don't, if you disagree, just no, let's leave it at that.
I don't hate him. I just don't have any interest in him at all. I don't really care about Dave Matthews one way
or
the other.
That's my thing.
I don't listen to him. But Patrick, it's like that whole, you know, like you're driving a spike into his head.
It's
it makes him so angry.
Angry reflex. Yeah. And I'm not talking about you. I'm just saying people. Like, you know, because I know that he is a college phase, I think, for most people. Most people I know who are big Dave Matthews fans became fans in college. Most of them then drifted away after college. But, you know, some people don't. You know, whatever. If you dig the guy, you know, have at it. I'm just saying, to me, it's like music where I just listen to it and I go, there's just nothing here. There's not even anything in the music for me to actively point to as bad. It's just sort of, it's like an eggplant. It's just, there's nothing there. Eggplants to me are, they're like a totally tasteless vegetable. There's no texture, no flavor, anything. That's what Dave Matthews is. Just a big, spongy marshmallow devoid of flavor. All right. On that note, we want to thank our guest, Joseph Rose from the – sorry. Tomorrow, Kelly Clark from Willamette Week will be here. Peter Carlin from the Oregonian Thursday. And on Friday, Brett Burmeister, who is a Portland blogger about the Portland food cart scene. So that is all in the way. The Rick Emerson Show comes to you live each and every weekday from the studios of the Emerson News Network. At the news desk is Dawn Taylor. Advanced technology and magic provided by Thomas Gill. Executive producer Bruce Sagler. Chief of staff Cheryl Kanakoa. The Rick Emerson Show made possible by a generous grant from you. My name is Rick Emerson. It is Tuesday, August 17th, 2010. And that is The Frequency, Kenneth. Thanks for listening. Be safe. See you all tomorrow. Bye now.
Attention broadcasters in the greater Portland area. Your daily show prep is now concluded. Thanks for listening.